an exaggerated diminution of the facts for poetic effect. Nonetheless, I will take you at your word and happily accept your challenge.
I'll be damned, said the Brit.
But I do have one condition, added the Count.
And what is that? Asked the German.
That for each of the contributions I name, we three shall drink a glass of vodka together.
The German, who was scowling, waved a hand in the air as if he were about to dismiss the Count, much as he had dismissed the country. But ever-attentive Odrius had already set three empty glasses on the bar and was filling them to the brim.
Thank you, Odrius.
My pleasure, Your Excellency.
Number one, said the Count, adding a pause for dramatic effect. Chekhov and Tolstoy.
The German let out a grunt.
Yes, yes, I know what you're going to say, that every nation has its poets in the pantheon, but with Chekhov and Tolstoy, we Russians have set the bronze bookends on the mantelpiece of narrative. Henceforth, writers of fictions from wheresoever they hail will place themselves on the continuum that begins with the one and ends with the other. For who, I ask you, has exhibited better mastery of the shorter form than Chekhov in his flawless little stories? Precise and uncluttered, they invite us into some corner of a household at some discreet hour in which the entire human condition is suddenly within reach, if heartbreakingly so. While, at the other extreme, can you conceive of a work greater in scope than War and Peace? One that moves so deftly from the parlour to the battlefield and back again? That so fully investigates how the individual is shaped by history, and history by the individual? In the generations to come, I tell you, there will be no new authors to supplant these two as the alpha and omega of narrative.
I dare say he has something there, said the Brit.
Then he raised his glass and emptied it. So the Count emptied his, and after a grumble, the German followed suit.
Number two, asked the Brit, as Odrius refilled the glasses. Act one, scene one of The Nutcracker.
Tchaikovsky, the German guffawed.
You laugh, mein Herr, and yet I would wager 1,000 crowns that you can picture it yourself. On Christmas Eve, having celebrated with family and friends in a room dressed with garlands, Clara sleeps soundly on the floor with her magnificent new toy. But at the stroke of midnight, with the one-eyed Drosselmeyer perched on the grandfather clock like an owl, the Christmas tree begins to grow.
As the Count raised his hand slowly over the bar to suggest the growth of the tree, the Brit began to whistle the famous march from the opening act.
Yes, exactly, said the Count to the Brit. It is commonly said that the English know how to celebrate Advent best. But with all due respect, to witness the essence of winter cheer, one must venture farther north than London. One must venture above the 50th parallel to where the course of the sun is its most elliptical and the force of the wind its most unforgiving. Dark, cold, and snowbound, Russia has the sort of climate in which the spirit of Christmas burns brightest, and that is why Tchaikovsky seems to have captured the sound of it better than anyone else. I tell you that not only will every European child of the 20th century know the melodies of the Nutcracker, they will imagine their Christmas just as it is depicted in the ballet. And on the Christmas eves of their dotage, Tchaikovsky's tree will grow from the floor of their memories until they are gazing up in wonder once again.
The Brit gave a sentimental laugh and emptied his glass.
The story was written by a Prussian, said the German, as he begrudgingly lifted his drink.
I grant you that, conceded the Count, and but for Tchaikovsky, it would have remained in Prussia.
As Odrius refilled the glasses, the ever-attentive tender at bar noted the Count's look of inquiry and replied with a nod of confirmation.
Third, said the Count.
Then, in lieu of explanation, he simply gestured to the Shalyapin's entrance, where a waiter suddenly appeared with a silver platter balanced on the palm of his hand. Placing the platter on the bar between the two foreigners, he lifted the dome to reveal a generous serving of caviar, accompanied by blini and sour cream. Even the German could not help but smile, his appetite getting the better of his prejudices. Anyone who has spent an hour drinking vodka by the glass knows that size has surprisingly little to do with a man's capacity. There are tiny men for whom the limit is 7, and giants for whom it is 2. For our German friend, the limit appeared to be 3. For if the Tolstoy dropped him in a barrel, and the Tchaikovsky set him adrift, then the caviar sent him over the falls. So, having wagged a chastising finger at the Count, he moved to the corner of the bar, laid his head on his arms, and dreamed of the sugar plum fairy. Taking this as a signal, the Count prepared to push back his stool, but the young Brit was refilling his glass.
"The caviar was a stroke of genius," he said. "But how did you manage it? You never left our sight."
"A magician never reveals his secrets." The Brit laughed. Then he studied the Count as if with renewed curiosity.
"Who are you?"
The Count shrugged. "I am someone you have met in a bar."
"No, that's not quite it. I know a man of erudition when I meet one. And I heard how the bartender referred to you. Who are you, really?"
The Count offered a self-deprecating smile.
"At one time I was Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov, recipient of the Order of St. Andrew, member of the Jockey Club, Master of the Hunt."
The young Brit held out his hand.
"Charles Abernethy, presumptive heir to the Earl of Westmoreland, financier's apprentice, and bowman of the losing Cambridge crew at Henley in 1920.
The two gentlemen shook hands and drank, and then the presumptive heir to the Earl of Westmoreland studied the Count again.
"This must have been quite a decade for you."
"You could put it that way," said the Count.
"Did you try to leave after the revolution?"
"On the contrary, Charles, I came back because of it." Charles looked at the Count in surprise.
"You came back?"
"I was in Paris when the Hermitage fell. I had left the country before the war due to certain circumstances."
"You weren't an anarchist, were you?"
The Count laughed.
"Hardly." "Then what?"
The Count looked into his empty glass. He hadn't spoken of these events in so many years.
"It is late," he said,
"and the story is long." By way of response, Charles refilled their glasses. So the Count took Charles all the way back to the fall of 1913, when, on an inclement night, he had set out for the 21st birthday of the Princess Novobatsky. He described the ice on the driveway, and Mrs. Trent's roast, and the torn IOU, and how a few degrees here and there had landed him on the terrace in the arms of the princess, while the rash lieutenant retched in the grass. Charles laughed.
"But, Alexander, that sounds splendid. Surely it's not the reason you left Russia?"
"No," admitted the Count, but then he continued with his fateful tale. 7 months passed, Charles. It is the spring of 1914, and I returned to the family estate for a visit. Having paid my respects to my grandmother in the library, I venture outside in search of my sister, Helena, who likes to read under the great elm at the bend in the river. From 100 feet away, I can tell that she is not herself. That is, I can tell that she is more than herself. Upon seeing me, she sits up with a sparkle in her eye and a smile on her lips, clearly eager to share some piece of news, which I am now equally eager to hear. But just as I cross the lawn toward her, she looks over my shoulder and smiles even more brightly to see a lone figure approaching on a steed. a lone figure in the uniform of the hussars. You see the dilemma the fox had put me in, Charles. While I had been carousing back in Moscow, he had sought my sister out. He had arranged an introduction and then courted her carefully, patiently, successfully. And when he swung down from the saddle and our eyes met, he could barely keep the twist of mirth from his lips. But how was I to explain the situation to Helena, this angel of a thousand virtues? How was I to tell her that the man she has fallen in love with has sought her affections not due to an appreciation of her qualities, but to settle a score? What did you do?
Ah, Charles, what did I do? I did nothing. I thought surely his true nature would find occasion to express itself, much as it had done at the Novobatskys. So, in the weeks that followed, I hovered at the edge of their courtship. I suffered through lunches and teas. I ground my teeth as I watched them stroll through the gardens. But as I bided my time, his self-control surpassed my wildest expectations. He pulled out her chair. He picked blossoms. He read verses. He wrote verses. And always, when he caught my eye, there was that little twist in his smile. But then, on the afternoon of my sister's 20th birthday, when he was off on manoeuvres and we were paying a visit to a neighbour, we returned at dusk to find his troika in front of our house. From a glance at Helena, I could sense her elation. "He has rushed back all the way from his battalion," she was thinking, "to wish me well on my day." She nearly jumped from her horse and ran up the steps, and I followed her like a condemned man to the noose. The Count emptied his glass and slowly set it back onto the bar. But there, inside the entry hall, I did not find my sister in his arms. I found her 2 steps from the door, trembling. Against the wall was Nadezhda, my sister's handmaiden. Her bodice torn open, her arms across her chest, her face scarlet with humiliation, she looked briefly at my sister, then ran up the stairs. In horror, my sister stumbled across the hall, collapsed in a chair, and covered her face with her hands. And our noble lieutenant? He grinned at me like a cat. When I began to express my outrage, he said, "Oh, come now, Alexander, it is Helena's birthday. In her honour, let us call it even." Then, roaring with laughter, he walked out the door without giving my sister a glance. Charles whistled softly. The Count nodded. "But at this juncture, Charles, I did not do nothing. I crossed the entryway to the wall where a pair of pistols hung beneath the family crest. When my sister grabbed at my sleeve and asked where I was going, I too walked out the door without giving her a glance." The Count shook his head in condemnation of his own behaviour. He had a 1-minute head start, but he hadn't used it to put distance between us. He had casually climbed into his troika and set his horses moving at little more than a trot. And there you have him in a nutshell, my friend, a man who raced toward parties and trotted from his own misdeeds. Charles refilled their glasses and waited. Our drive was a grand circle that connected the house to the main road by 2 opposing arcs lined with apple trees. My horse was still tied at its post, so, when I saw him riding away, I mounted and set off in the opposite direction at a gallop. In a matter of minutes I had reached the point where the 2 arcs of the drive met the road. Dismounting, I stood and waited for his approach. You can picture the scene. Me alone in the drive with the sky blue, the breeze blowing and the apple trees in bloom. Though he had left the house at little more than a trot, when he saw me, he rose to his feet, raised his whip, and began driving his horses at full speed. There was no question as to what he intended to do. So, without a second thought, I raised my arm, steadied my aim, and pulled the trigger. The impact of the bullet knocked him off his feet.
The reins flew free, and the horses careened off the drive, rolling the troika and tossing him into the dust, where he lay unmoving.
You killed him?
Yes, Charles. I killed him. The presumptive heir to the Earl of Westmoreland slowly nodded his head.
Right there in the dust?
The Count sighed and took a drink. No, it was 8 months later. Charles looked confused.
8 months later?
Yes, in February 1915. You see, ever since my youth I had been known for my marksmanship, and I had every intention of shooting the brute in the heart. But the road was uneven, and he was whipping his reins, and the apple blossoms were blowing about in the wind. In a word, I missed my mark. I ended up shooting him here. The Count touched his right shoulder.
So, then you didn't kill him?
Not at that moment. After binding his wound and righting his troika, I drove him home. Along the way he cursed me at every turn of the wheel, and deservedly so. For while he survived the gunshot wound, with his right arm now lame, he was forced to surrender his commission in the Hussars. And when his father filed an official complaint, my grandmother sent me to Paris, as was the custom at the time. But later that summer, when the war broke out, despite his injury, he insisted upon resuming his place at the head of his regiment. And in the second battle of the Masurian Lakes, he was knocked from his horse and run through with a bayonet by an Austrian dragoon. There was a moment of silence.
Alexander, I am sorry that this fellow died in battle, but I think I can safely say that you have assumed more than your share of guilt for these events.
But there is one more event to relate. 10 years ago tomorrow, while I was biding my time in Paris, my sister died.
Of a broken heart?
Young women only die of broken hearts in novels, Charles. She died of scarlet fever. The presumptive Earl shook his head in bewilderment.
But don't you see, explained the Count, it is a chain of events.
That night at the Novobatskys, when I magnanimously tore his marker, I knew perfectly well that word of the act would reach the princess, and I took the greatest satisfaction in turning the tables on the cad. But if I had not so smugly put him in his place, he would not have pursued Helena. He would not have humiliated her. I would not have shot him. He might not have died in Masuria. And 10 years ago I would have been where I belonged, at my sister's side, when she finally breathed her last. Having capped off his snifter of brandy with 6 glasses of vodka, when the Count emerged from the attic hatch shortly before midnight, he weaved across the hotel's roof. With the wind a little wild, and the building shifting back and forth, one could almost imagine one was crossing the deck of a ship on high seas. How fitting, thought the Count, as he paused to steady himself at a chimney stack. Then, picking his way among the irregular shadows that jutted here and there, he approached the building's northwest corner. For one last time, the Count looked out upon that city that was and wasn't his. Given the frequency of street lamps on major roads, he could easily identify the boulevard and garden rings, those concentric circles at the centre of which was the Kremlin, and beyond which was all of Russia. As long as there have been men on earth, reflected the Count, there have been men in exile. From primitive tribes to the most advanced societies, someone has occasionally been told by his fellow men to pack his bags, cross the border, and never set foot on his native soil again. But perhaps this was to be expected. After all, exile was the punishment that God meted out to Adam in the very first chapter of the human comedy, and that he meted out to Cain a few pages later. Yes, exile was as old as mankind. But the Russians were the first people to master the notion of sending a man into exile at home. As early as the 18th century, The Tsars stopped kicking their enemies out of the country, opting instead to send them to Siberia. Why? Because they had determined that to exile a man from Russia as God had exiled Adam from Eden was insufficient as a punishment. For in another country, a man might immerse himself in his labours, build a house, raise a family. That is, he might begin his life anew. But when you exile a man into his own country, there is no beginning anew. For the exile at home, whether he be sent to Siberia or subject to the -6, the love for his country will not become vague or shrouded by the mists of time. In fact, because we have evolved as a species to pay the utmost attention to that which is just beyond our reach, these men are likely to dwell on the splendours of Moscow more than any Muscovite who is at liberty to enjoy them. But enough of all that. Having retrieved a Bordeaux glass from the ambassador, the Count set it on a chimney top. He wrested the cork from the labelless bottle of Chateauneuf de Pape that he had taken from the Metropole cellar back in 1924. Even as he poured the wine, he could tell it was an excellent vintage, perhaps from 1900 or 1921. With his glass filled, he raised it in the direction of Idlehour. "To Helena Rostov," he said, "the flower of Nizhny Novgorod, lover of Pushkin, defender of Alexander, embroiderer of every pillowcase within reach. A life too brief, a heart too kind." Then he drank to the bottom of the glass. Though the bottle was far from empty, the Count did not refill the glass, nor did he toss it over his shoulder. Rather, he placed it with care on the chimney top, and then approached the parapet, where he stood to his full height. Before him sprawled the city, glorious and grandiose. Its legions of lights shimmered and reeled until they mixed with the movement of the stars. In one dizzy sphere they spun, confusing the works of man with the works of heaven. Placing his right foot on the parapet's edge, Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov said, "Goodbye, my country." As if in reply, the beacon on Mishka's tower blinked. It was now the simplest of matters. Like one who stands on a dock in spring preparing to take the first plunge of the season, all that remained was a leap. Starting just 6 stories off the ground and falling at the speed of a kopeck, a teacup, or a pineapple, the entire journey would only take a matter of seconds, and then the circle would be complete. For as sunrise leads to sunset and dust to dust, as every river returns to the sea, just so a man must return to the embrace of oblivion, from whence...
"Your Excellency!"
Turning in dismay at the interruption, the Count discovered Abram standing behind him in a state of excitement. In fact, Abram was in such a state of excitement that he showed not the slightest surprise at finding the Count poised on the spot where the roof met the ether.
"I thought I heard your voice," said the old handyman. "I'm so glad you're here. You must come with me at once."
"Abram, my friend," the Count began to explain, but the old man continued unabated.
"You will not believe it if I tell you. You will have to see it for yourself."
Then, without waiting for a response, he hurried with surprising agility toward his encampment. The Count let out a sigh. Assuring the city that he would be back in a moment, he followed Abram across the roof to the brazier, where the old man stopped and pointed to the northeast corner of the hotel. And there, against the brightly lit backdrop of the Bolshoi, one could just make out a frenzy of tiny shadows darting through the air.
"They've returned!" Abram exclaimed.
"The bees?"
"Yes, but that is not all. Sit, sit!"
Abram gestured toward the plank of wood that had so often served as the Count's chair. As the Count stood the plank on end, Abram bent over his makeshift table. On it was a tray from one of the hives. He cut into the comb with a knife, spread the honey on a spoon, and handed it to the Count. Then he stood back with a smile of anticipation.
"Well?"
he prompted.
"Go ahead."
Dutifully, the Count put the spoon in his mouth. In an instant, there was the familiar sweetness of fresh honey, sunlit, golden, and gay. Given the time of year, the Count was expecting this first impression to be followed by a hint of lilacs from the Alexander Gardens, or cherry blossoms from the garden ring. But as the elixir dissolved on his tongue, the Count became aware of something else entirely. Rather than the flowering trees of central Moscow, the honey had a hint of a grassy river bank, the trace of a summer breeze, a suggestion of a pergola. But most of all, there was the unmistakable essence of a thousand apple trees in bloom. Abram was nodding his head.
"Nizhny Novgorod," he said.
And it was, unmistakably so.
"All these years, they must have been listening to us,"
Abram added in a whisper. The Count and the handyman both looked toward the roof's edge, where the bees, having travelled over 100 miles and applied themselves in willing industry, now wheeled above their hives as pinpoints of blackness, like the inverse of stars. It was nearly 2 in the morning when the Count bid Abram good night and returned to his bedroom. Taking the gold coin from his pocket, he placed it back on the stack inside the leg of his godfather's desk, where it would remain untouched for another 28 years. And the following evening at 6, when the Boyarsky opened, the Count was the first one through its doors.
"André," he said to the maitre d', "can you spare a moment?"
Book 3. 1930. Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov stirred at 8:30 to the sound of rain on the eaves. With a half-opened eye, he pulled back his covers and climbed from bed. He donned his robe and slipped on his slippers. He took up the tin from the bureau, spooned a spoonful of beans into the apparatus, and began to crank the crank. Even as he turned the little handle round and round, the room remained under the tenuous authority of sleep. As yet unchallenged, somnolence continued to cast its shadow over sights and sensations, over forms and formulations, over what has been said and what must be done, lending each the insubstantiality of its domain. But when the Count opened the small wooden drawer of the grinder, the world and all it contained were transformed by that envy of the alchemists, the aroma of freshly ground coffee. In that instant, darkness was separated from light, the waters from the lands, and the heavens from the earth. The trees bore fruit, and the woods rustled with the movement of birds and beasts, and all manner of creeping things. While closer at hand, a patient pigeon scuffed its feet on the flashing. Easing the little drawer from the apparatus, the Count poured its contents into the pot, which he had mindfully primed with water the night before. He lit the burner and shook out the match. As he waited for the coffee to brew, he did 30 squats and 30 stretches and took 30 deep breaths. From the little cupboard in the corner, he took a small pitcher of cream, a pair of English biscuits, and a piece of fruit, today an apple. Then, having poured the coffee, he began to enjoy the morning's sensations to their fullest. The crisp tartness of the apple, the hot bitterness of the coffee, the savoury sweetness of the biscuit with its hint of spoiled butter. So perfect was the combination that upon finishing, the Count was tempted to crank the crank, quarter the apple, dole out the biscuits, and enjoy his breakfast all over again. But time and tide wait for no man. So, having poured the remnants of the coffee from its pot, The Count brushed the biscuit crumbs from his plate onto the window ledge for his feathered friend. Then he emptied the little pitcher of cream into a saucer and turned toward the door with the intention of placing it in the hall. And that was when he saw the envelope on the floor. Someone must have slipped it under his door in the middle of the night. Setting the saucer down for his one-eyed friend, he picked up the envelope and discovered that it had an unusual feel, as if something quite different than a letter had been enclosed. On the back, it bore the dark blue moniker of the hotel, while on the front, in place of a name and address, was written the query, 4 o'clock? The Count sat on his bed and took the last sip of coffee. Then he tucked the point of his paring knife under the envelope's flap, slit it from corner to corner, and gazed within. Mon Dieu, he said. Arachne's Art. History is the business of identifying momentous events from the comfort of a high-backed chair. With the benefit of time, the historian looks back and points to a date in the manner of a grey-haired field marshal pointing to a bend in a river on a map. There it was, he says, the turning point, the decisive factor, the fateful day that fundamentally altered all that was to follow. There on the 3rd of January 1928, the historians tell us, was the launch of the first five-year plan, that initiative which would begin the transformation of Russia from a 19th-century agrarian society into a 20th-century industrial power. There on the 17th of November 1929, Nikolai Bukharin, founding father, editor of Pravda, and last true friend of the peasant, was outmaneuvered by Stalin and ousted from the Politburo, clearing the way for a return to autocracy in all but name. And there, on the 25th of February 1927, was the drafting of Article 58 of the Criminal Code, the net that would eventually ensnare us all. There on the 27th of May, or there on the 6th of December, at 8 or 9 in the morning. There it was, they say, as if, like at the opera, the curtain has closed, a lever has been pulled, one set has been whisked to the rafters, and another has dropped to the stage, such that when the curtain opens a moment later, the audience will find itself transported from a richly appointed ballroom to the banks of a wooded stream. But the events that transpired on those various dates did not throw the city of Moscow into upheaval. When the page was torn from the calendar, the bedroom windows did not suddenly shine with the light of a million electric lamps. That fatherly gaze did not suddenly hang over every desk and appear in every dream. Nor did the drivers of 100 black Mariahs turn the keys in their ignitions and fan out into the shadowy streets. For the launch of the first five-year plan, Bukharin's fall from grace and the expansion of the criminal code to allow the arrest of anyone even countenancing dissension, these were only tidings, omens, underpinnings, and it would be a decade before their effects were fully felt. No, for most of us, the late 1920s were not characterized by a series of momentous events. Rather, the passage of those years was like the turn of a kaleidoscope. At the bottom of a kaleidoscope cylinder lie shards of coloured glass in random arrangement. But thanks to a glint of sunlight, the interplay of mirrors and the magic of symmetry, when one peers inside, what one finds is a pattern so colourful, so perfectly intricate, it seems certain to have been designed with the utmost care. Then, by the slightest turn of the wrist, the shards begin to shift and settle into a new configuration, a configuration with its own symmetry of shapes, its own intricacy of colours, its own hints of design. So it was in the city of Moscow in the late 1920s, and so it was at the Metropole Hotel. In fact, if a seasoned Muscovite were to cross Theatre Square on the last day of spring in 1930, He would find the hotel much as he remembered it. There on the front step still stands Pavel Ivanovich in his greatcoat, looking as stalwart as ever, though his hip now gives him some trouble on foggy afternoons. On the other side of the revolving doors are the same eager lads in the same blue caps, ready to whisk one's suitcases up the stairs, though they now answer to Grisha and Genya rather than Pasha and Petya. Vasily, with his uncanny awareness of whereabouts, still mans the concierge's desk, directly across from Arkady, who remains ready to spin the register and offer you a pen. And in the manager's office, Mr. Halecki still sits behind his spotless desk, though a new assistant manager with that smile of an ecclesiast is prone to interrupt his reveries over the slightest infraction of the hotel's rules. In the piazza, Russians cut from every cloth, or at least those who have access to foreign currency, gather to linger over coffee and happen upon friends. While in the ballroom, the weighty remarks and late arrivals that once characterized the assemblies now characterize dinners of state, though no one with a penchant for yellow spies from the balcony anymore. And the Boyarsky? At 2 o'clock, its kitchen is already in full swing. Along the wooden tables, the junior chefs are chopping carrots and onions, as Stanislav, the sous chef, delicately debones pigeons with a whistle on his lips. On the great stoves, 8 burners have been lit to simmer sauces, soups, and stews. The pastry chef, who seems as dusted with flour as one of his rolls, opens an oven door to withdraw 2 trays of brioche. And in the center of all this activity, with an eye on every assistant and a finger in every pot, stands Emil Zhukovsky, his chopping knife in hand. If the kitchen of the Boyarsky is an orchestra and Emil its conductor, then his chopping knife is the baton. With a blade 2 inches wide at the base and 10 inches long to the tip, it is rarely out of his hand and never far from reach. Though the kitchen is outfitted with paring knives, boning knives, carving knives, and cleavers, Emil can complete any of the various tasks for which those knives were designed with his 10-inch chopper. With it, he can skin a rabbit. He can zest a lemon. He can peel and quarter a grape. He can use it to flip a pancake or stir a soup. And with the stabbing end, he can measure out a teaspoon of sugar or a dash of salt. But most of all, he uses it for pointing.
"You," he says to the saucier, waving the point of his chopper. "Are you going to boil that to nothing? What are you going to use it for, eh? To pave roads? To paint icons?" "You," he says to the conscientious new apprentice at the end of the counter. "What are you doing there? It took less time for that parsley to grow than for you to mince it."
And on the last day of spring, it is Stanislav who receives the tip of the knife. For in the midst of trimming the fat from racks of lamb, Emil suddenly stops and glares across the table.
"You,"
he says, pointing the chopper at Stanislav's nose.
"What is that?"
Stanislav, a lanky Estonian who has dutifully studied his master's every move, looks up from his pigeons with startled eyes.
"What is what, sir?"
"What is that you're whistling?"
Admittedly, there has been a melody playing in Stanislav's head, a little something that he had heard the night before while passing the entrance of the hotel's bar, but he had not been conscious of whistling it. And now that he faces the chopper, he cannot for the life of him remember what the melody was.
"I am not certain," he confesses.
"Not certain? Were you whistling or weren't you?"
"Yes, sir. It was I who must have been whistling, but I assure you it was just a ditty."
"Just a ditty?"
"A little song."
"I know what a ditty is, but under what authority are you whistling one, eh? Has the Central Committee made you Commissar of Ditty Whistling? Is that the grand order of dittiness I see pinned to your chest?"
Without looking down, Emile slams his chopper to the counter, splitting a lamb chop from its rack as if he were severing the melody from Stanislav's memory once and for all. The chef raises his chopper again and points its tip. But before he can elaborate, that door which separates Emile's kitchen from the rest of the world swings open. It is André, as prompt as ever, with his book in hand and a pair of spectacles resting on the top of his head. Like a brigand after a skirmish, Emile slips his chopper under the tie of his apron and then looks expectantly at the door, which a moment later swings again. With the slightest turn of the wrist, the shards of glass tumble into a new arrangement. The blue cap of the bellhop is handed from one boy to the next. A dress as yellow as a canary is stowed in a trunk. A little red guidebook is updated with the new names of streets. And through Emile's swinging door walks Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov, with the white dinner jacket of the Boyarsky draped across his arm. 1 minute later, sitting at the table in the little office overlooking the kitchen, were Emile, André, and the Count, that triumvirate which met each day at 2:15 to decide the fate of the restaurant's staff, its customers, its chickens and tomatoes. As was customary, André convened the meeting by resting his reading glasses on the tip of his nose and opening the book. "There are no parties in the private rooms tonight," he began, "but every table in the dining room is reserved for two seatings."
"Ah," said Emile with the grim smile of the commander who prefers to be outnumbered. "But you're not going to rush them, eh?"
"Absolutely not," assured the Count.
"We'll simply see to it that their menus are delivered promptly and their orders taken directly."
Emile nodded in acknowledgement.
"Are there any complications?" asked the Count of the maitre d'.
"Nothing out of the ordinary." André spun the book so that his head waiter could see for himself. The Count ran a finger down the list of reservations. As André had said, there was nothing out of the ordinary. The Commissar of Transport loathed American journalists. The German ambassador loathed the Commissar of Transport. And the deputy head of the OGPU was loathed by all. Established in 1923, the OGPU replaced the Cheka as Russia's central organ of the secret police. In 1934, the OGPU would be replaced by the NKVD, which in turn would be replaced by the MGB in 1943 and the KGB in 1954. On the surface, this may seem confusing, but the good news is that unlike political parties, artistic movements, or schools of fashion, which go through such sweeping reinventions, the methodologies and intentions of the secret police never change. So you should feel no need to distinguish one acronym from the next. The most delicate matter was that two different members of the Politburo were hosting tables during the second seating. As both were relatively new to their positions, it was not essential that either have the best tables in the house. What was essential was that their treatment be identical in every respect. They must be served with equal attention at tables of equal size, equidistant from the kitchen door. And ideally, they would be on opposite sides of the centerpiece. Tonight, an arrangement of irises. "What do you think?" asked André, with his pen in hand. As the Count made his suggestions of who should sit where, there came a delicate knock on the door. Stanislav entered, carrying a serving bowl and platter.
"Good day, gentlemen,"
the sous-chef said to André and the Count with a friendly smile.
"In addition to our normal fare, tonight we have cucumber soup and—"
"Yes, yes," said Emile with a scowl. "We know, we know."
Stanislav apologetically placed the bowl and platter on the table, even as Emile waved him from the room. Once he was gone, the chef gestured at the offering.
"In addition to our normal fare, tonight we have cucumber soup and rack of lamb with a red wine reduction."
On the table were three teacups, Emile ladled the soup into two of the cups and waited for his colleagues to sample it.
Excellent, said André.
Emile nodded and then turned to the Count with his eyebrows raised.
A puree of peeled cucumber, thought the Count.
Yogurt, of course. A bit of salt. Not as much dill as one might expect. In fact, something else entirely. Something that speaks just as eloquently of summer's approach, but with a little more flair.
Mint?
He asked. The chef responded with a smile of the bested.
Bravo, monsieur.
To anticipate the lamb, the Count added with appreciation. Emile bowed his head once and then, slipping the chopper from his waist, he carved four chops from the rack and stacked two on each of his colleagues' plates. The lamb, which had been encrusted with rosemary and breadcrumbs, was savoury and tender. Both maitre d' and head waiter sighed in appreciation. Thanks to a member of the Central Committee, who had tried unsuccessfully to order a bottle of Bordeaux for the new French ambassador in 1927, wines with labels could once again be found in the Metropole cellar. After all, despite its considerable size, the neck of a dragon has been known to whip about like that of an asp. So, turning to the Count, André asked what he thought they should recommend with the lamb.
For those who can afford it, the Chateau Latour 99.
The chef and maitre d' nodded.
And for those who cannot?
The Count considered.
Perhaps a Côte du Rhône?
Excellent, said André. Picking up his chopper, Emile pointed at the rest of the rack and cautioned the Count.
Tell your boys that my lamb is served rare. If someone wants it medium, they can go to a canteen.
The Count expressed his comprehension and willingness to comply. Then André closed the book and Emile wiped his chopper. But as they began pushing back their chairs, the Count remained where he was.
Gentlemen, he said, just one more thing before we adjourn.
Given the expression on the Count's face, the chef and the maitre d' pulled their chairs back to the table. The Count looked through the window into the kitchen to confirm that the staff were consumed with their work. Then, from his jacket pocket, he took the envelope that had been slipped under his door. When he tipped it over Emile's unused teacup, out poured filaments of a red and golden hue. The three men were silent for a moment. Emile sat back.
Bravo, he said again.
May I?
Asked André.
Certainly.
André picked up the teacup and tipped it back and forth. Then he replaced it so gently on its saucer that the porcelain didn't make a sound.
Is it enough?
Having watched the filaments spill from the envelope, the chef didn't need a second look.
Without a doubt.
Do we still have the fennel?
There are a few bulbs at the back of the larder. We'll have to discard the outer leaves, but otherwise they're fine.
Did you hear back about the oranges?
Asked the Count. With a somber look, the chef shook his head.
How many would we need?
Asked André.
Two, maybe three.
I think I know where some can be found.
Can they be found today?
Asked the chef. André pulled a pocket watch from his vest and consulted it in the palm of his hand.
With any luck.
Where would André be able to acquire three oranges on such short notice? Another restaurant? One of the special stores for hard currencies? A patron in the upper echelons of the party?
Well, for that matter, where did the Count acquire an ounce and a half of saffron?
Such questions had stopped being asked years ago. Suffice it to say, the saffron was in hand, and the oranges within reach. The three conspirators exchanged satisfied glances and then pushed back their chairs. André put his glasses back on his head as Emile turned to the Count.
You'll get the menus in their hands directly and their orders taken promptly, eh? No malingering?
No malingering.
Well then, concluded the chef, we meet at 12:30.
When the Count left the Boyarsky with his white jacket draped across his arm, there was a smile on his lips and a jauntiness to his step. In fact, there was a brightness in his whole demeanour.
Greetings, Grisha, he said as he passed the bellhop, who was on his way up the stairs with a vase of tiger lilies, 2 feet tall. Guten Tag, he said to the lovely young Fräulein in the lavender blouse, who was waiting by the elevator door.
The Count's good humour was due, in part, no doubt, to the reading on the thermometer. Over the previous 3 weeks, the temperature had climbed 4.5 degrees, setting in motion that course of natural and human events which culminates in hints of mint in cucumber soups, lavender blouses at elevator doors, and midday deliveries of tiger lilies 2 feet tall. Also lightening his step were the promises of an afternoon assignation and a midnight rendezvous. But the factor that most directly contributed to the Count's good humour was the double bravo from Emile. This was something that had occurred only once or twice in 4 years. Passing through the lobby, the Count returned the friendly wave from the new fellow at the mail window and hailed Vasily, who was hanging up his phone, having undoubtedly secured another 2 tickets for some sold-out performance.
Good afternoon, my friend. Hard at work, I see.
In acknowledgement, the concierge gestured to the lobby, which bustled almost as much as it had in its pre-war prime. As if on cue, the telephone on his desk began to ring. The bellhop's bell triple chimed, and someone called out, Comrade! Comrade!
Ah, comrade, thought the Count. Now there was a word for the ages.
When the Count was a boy in St. Petersburg, one rarely bumped into it. It was always prowling at the back of a mill or under the table in a tavern, occasionally leaving its paw marks on the freshly printed pamphlets that were drying on a basement floor. Now, 30 years later, it was the most commonly heard word in the Russian language. A wonder of semantic efficiency, comrade could be used as a greeting or a word of parting, as a congratulations or a caution, as a call to action or a remonstrance, or it could simply be the means of securing someone's attention in the crowded lobby of a grand hotel. And thanks to the word's versatility, the Russian people had finally been able to dispense with tired formalities, antiquated titles, bothersome idioms, even names. Where else in all of Europe could one shout a single word to hail any of one's countrymen, be they male or female, young or old, friend or foe?
Comrade! Someone called again,
this time with a little more urgency. And then he tugged on the Count's sleeve. Startled, the Count turned to find the new fellow from the mail window at his elbow.
Well, hello there. How can I be of service to you, young man?
The fellow looked perplexed at the Count's question, having assumed that it was his position to be of service to someone else.
There is a letter for you, he explained.
For me?
Yes, comrade, it came yesterday.
The young fellow pointed back toward the window to indicate where the letter remained.
Well, in that case, after you, said the Count.
Civil servant and customer proceeded to their appropriate stations on either side of that small window which separates the written from the read.
Here it is,
he said, after a moment of sorting.
Thank you, my good man.
Taking the envelope in hand, the Count was half expecting to find it addressed to Comrade, but there, under 2 postage stamps bearing the likeness of Lenin, was the Count's full name, written in an indifferently groomed, relatively reclusive, occasionally argumentative script. When the Count had come down to the lobby from the Boyarsky, he had been on his way to the office of the Shy Delight, where he hoped to secure a length of white thread for a button that had been compromised on his jacket. But he had not seen Mishka in almost 1/2 a year, and at the very moment that he recognized his old friend's script, a lady with a lapdog rose from his favourite chair between the potted palms. Ever respectful of fate, the Count postponed his visit to the seamstress, claimed his seat, and opened the letter. Leningrad, June 14, 1930. Dear Sasha, at 4 this morning, unable to sleep, I ventured out into the old city. As the revelers of the White Knights had already stumbled home and the tram conductors had yet to don their caps, I strolled along Nevsky Prospect through a stillness of spring that seemed stolen from another province, if not another time. Nevsky, like the city itself, bears a new name. October 25th Prospect. A worthy day, staking its claim on a storied street. But at this hour, it was just as you remember it, my friend. And with no destination in mind, I crossed the Moika and Fontanka canals. I passed the shops and the rose-hued facades of the grand old homes until, at last, I reached Tikhvin Cemetery, where the bodies of Dostoevsky and Tchaikovsky slumber a few feet apart. Do you remember how late into the night we would debate the genius of the one over the other? And suddenly it struck me that walking the length of Nevsky Prospect was like walking the length of Russian literature. Right there at the beginning, just off the avenue of the Moika embankment, is the house where Pushkin ended his years. A few paces on are the rooms where Gogol began Dead Souls. Then the National Library, where Tolstoy scoured the archives. And here, behind the cemetery walls, lies Brother Fyodor, our restless witness of the human soul entombed beneath the cherry trees. As I was standing lost in thought, the sun rose above the cemetery walls, shining its light down the prospect, and, nearly overcome, I recalled that great affirmation, that proclamation, that promise, always to shine everywhere, to the very depths of the last days. Before turning to the second page of his old friend's letter, the Count found himself looking up, deeply moved. It was not the memories of St. Petersburg that affected him so, not some nostalgia for his youth among the rose-hued facades, or for his years with Mishka in the apartment above the cobbler's. Nor was it Mishka's sentimental reminders of Russia's literary greatness. What moved the Count was the thought of his old friend venturing out into this stolen spring, barely aware of where he was headed. For from the letter's first line, the Count had known exactly where Mishka was headed. It had been 4 years since Mishka had moved to Kiev with Katerina. It had been 1 year since she had left him for another man, and 6 months since he had returned to St. Petersburg to barricade himself once again behind his books. Then one spring night at 4 in the morning, unable to sleep, he finds himself on Nevsky Prospect, following the very same route that he had walked with Katerina on the day that she had first taken his hand. And there, as the sun begins to rise, he is overcome with thoughts of an affirmation, a proclamation, a promise. A promise to shine everywhere and always to very depths of the last days, which, after all, is all that anyone has ever asked of love. As these thoughts pass through the Count's mind, was he concerned that Mishka still pined for Katerina? Was he concerned that his old friend was morbidly retracing the footsteps of a lapsed romance? Concerned? Mishka would pine for Katerina the rest of his life. Never again would he walk Nevsky Prospect, however they chose to rename it, without feeling an unbearable sense of loss. And that is just how it should be. That sense of loss is exactly what we must anticipate, prepare for, and cherish to the last of our days. For it is only our heartbreak that finally refutes all that is ephemeral in love. The Count picked up Mishka's letter with the intention of reading on, but as he turned the page, 3 youths leaving the piazza happened to stop on the other side of one of the potted palms to carry on some weighty conversation. The trio was made up of a good-looking Komsomol type in his early 20s, and two younger women, one blonde, one brunette. The three were apparently headed for the Ivanovo province, in some official capacity, and the young man,